Okay, well, this is the Yates podcast, and there's a lot of ground to cover with him. He's this giant in 20th century literature, in Irish literature, in literature of a colonized country, in literature of a national identity. Right? If you take a look at the biographical information, you see that he's very active in, you know, he founds what's known as the Irish Literary Renaissance. The idea at the turn of the 20th century, this idea that he has, that is, that in order for a country to really kind of identify itself and explore its own culture, it needs to make a national theater that is about what's going on in their country, about the myths, about the stories, about the origin tales, about the folk tales that come up. And he does this. He successfully founds the Abbey Theater, which we're going to see throughout the 20th century, people like Derek Walcott and Wolso Jinka doing the same thing in their countries as a way of kind of jump-starting a sense of national identity when they've been colonized. And of course, Yeats is from Ireland, although, as we're going to see in Easter 1916, he pretty much, like, for his adult life, he spends more time in London than he does in Dublin. So he identifies with the English. He's a member of the what we call the Protestant ascendancy, which is basically the upper classes in Ireland at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. These people who like the status quo, who like being a colony or being united with Great Britain. Even though, you know, they 50 years before, they had a great example of just how Great Britain treats them with the great Irish famine and Gota Mór, right, the great hunger. Yeats starts out as you know, he wants to be a painter, and he doesn't succeed very well at it. His father was a painter and his brother were painters, great painters, both have work in the National Gallery in Ireland. So Yeats turns his hand to poetry, and he's pretty good at it. And at the beginning, we can see that he's pretty much a kind of a late romantic against the Victorian ideals that were in place at that time. That first poem we're looking at, When You Are Old, is a prime example of this. Now, he writes this to a woman who's going to be kind of important throughout his life, Maud Gunn, G-O-N-N-E. You'll see her on the biographical stuff as well. He loves her so much, he proposed to her three times that I know of. I had a graduate student who said that he found sources that said that he proposed to her at least 8 times. She rejected him each time. She ends up marrying one of the guys who's in charge of or who leads the Easter Rebellion in 1916. Who treats her pretty poorly, but Yeats is just kind of madly, madly, madly in love with this girl who's the exact opposite of him. She's an actress, she's very good looking, and Yeats was good looking. But Yeats is more of a private guy and kind of definitely a member of the upper class, definitely erudite, definitely intelligent. Maud was intelligent as well, but she was also, she was revolutionary. She was, at the time, the term was a Republican because she wanted a Republic of Ireland. Yeats also has a lifelong fascination with the occult, the Rosicrucian Society, the Golden Dawn, the Hermetic Society. You see, he founds the Dublin Hermetic Society. This Gnostic idea, that's G-N-O-S-T-I-C, this idea that there's a truth behind the truths of this world, and certain people, certain initiates, can get that revealed to them. And Yeats believed himself to be one of these initiates. That's going to inform the last two poems we look at, Leda and the Swan, and the Second Coming, this concept that he has of gyres, which you'll be able to see on the second Yeats page. Anyhow, Yeats, toward the end of his life, kind of he becomes internationally famous, right? Wins the Nobel Prize. Is when Ireland is declared a free state, he gets appointed a senator for the free state. He's not a politician. He's good at making speeches, but he's not a politician. And so the politicians give him a job of basically checking to see that the national curriculum is taught at schools, and he gets to help design the currency, the new money. Both pretty symbolic jobs, which is fair enough for a guy who makes his living writing symbolic poetry. This first poem, When You Are Old, is a series, as I said, a series of five poems on the dangers to love, old age, death, boredom. I can't remember the other ones, but it's a nice little poem, right? It's a beautiful poem, and it looks on one hand to be just this sweet little love poem. And then on the other hand, it plays with this long tradition in English literature of seduction poetry. Going back to at least the Renaissance, this idea that poets, they write because they want to woo women. And this technique that he uses here is one that we've seen from the Renaissance on. When you are old and gray and full of sleep and nodding by the fire, take down this book and slowly read and dream of the soft look your eyes had once and of their shadows deep. How many loved your moments of glad grace and loved your beauty with love false or true? But one man loved the pilgrim soul in you and loved the sorrows of your changing face. And bending down beside the glowing bars, murmur a little sadly how love fled and paced upon the mountains overhead and hid his face amid a crowd of stars. Now that's a sweet little 12-line poem, three stanzas, right? He kind of hides the rhyme scheme in it. You see it's A, B, B, A in that first stanza, and well, the second stanza as well. Love fled and overhead. He does it throughout there, so it doesn't sound like it's your typical sing-songy poem. And what he's setting up is, now he and Maud are both very young when he writes this. This is written in the 1870s, I think. Maybe the 1880s. Yeah, had to be the 1880s, I guess. He's asking Maud to imagine herself as an old woman, right? When you're old and gray, she's not old and gray now, when you're old and gray, take down this book, the book that contains these poems, and remember what you look like now. The soft look your eyes had once and of their shadows deep. And remember all those suitors in that second stanza. Remember all those men who were in love with you because you were beautiful, right? And they loved your moments of glad grace. They saw you on the stage and they thought that that was you. But one man, and of course Yeats is talking about himself, loved the pilgrim soul in you and loved the sorrows of your changing face. I loved you differently, right? Those men loved you when you were glad and happy and you looked good and you were easy to manage and things went well. But I loved you when you were sad, and it wasn't about your external beauty. It was about your soul. It was about this connection I had with you. And then that the killer last stanza here, right? Bending down beside the glowing bars, right? Murmur a little sadly how love fled, right? And so you're old and you've got this book. The glowing bars is the andirons in the fire, the things that are going to hold those typical peat fires in Ireland. How love fled and paced upon the mountains overhead, right? And notice love there, it's a capital L. Well, that's Yeats talking about himself, how love fled. Love left you because you didn't return it in the way you needed to. That's me, capital L. I'm Dr. Love, I'm capital L Love, right? And I'm gonna leave you unless you return it, right? And you will be filled with regret later on down the line, maybe not now, maybe not next year, maybe not 5 years from now, but when you're old, this is going to be the great regret of your life. Because me, I'm going places. I am going to be above you. Not only am I going to pace upon the mountains overhead, but I'm going to hide my face in a crowd of stars. I'm going to become a constellation like the Greek gods, like these great heroes of old, right? I'm going to be apotheosized into this, like, this is how iconic my love for you is. And you're turning it away. Like I said, on one hand, that's a great love poem. On the other hand, it's like, it's an ultimatum. You're going to regret this. You're paid. So take advantage of who and what you are now so that, you know, love will stay. Now, the second poem, right, is in commemoration of the Easter Rebellion of 1916. And there's if you look at the Irish history site, I don't think I put a link to it, but if you look on my teaching page, you'll see a thing that says Irish history since 1850 that'll talk about the Easter Revolution, the Easter 1916 Rising. And this poem Yeats wrote in September of that year to commemorate it, right? It was a failed rebellion where a bunch of rebels tried to take over the most heavily, the most easily fortifiable buildings in downtown Dublin, one of which was the General Post Office. They weren't great military planners. They did it over the Easter weekend because that's known as a bank holiday, so it's like a five-day weekend. So they got in there and they fortified for a couple days. Easter Monday or Easter Tuesday showed up and they got clobbered. They were completely wiped out. And Yeats sets this up. And he plays with this idea of numerology here. If you look at the stanza layout there, you've got four stanzas, right? Two of them have 16 verses, two of them have 24. 16 and 24, 16 and 24. Well, if you add 16 and 24 together, you get 40. And 40 carries a lot of baggage, right? We've got two sections of 40. 40 days and 40 nights, 40 years of exile and wandering in the desert, right? 40 days of fasting, 40 days of Lent, 40 days of Easter, 40 days of Eastertide. Well, 50 days of Eastertide. 40 days of Christmastide, if you include up to Epiphany, right? These are really significant numbers that signify exile and longing. It rained for 40 days, so there was punishment and the cleansing of the earth for 40 days, all of them biblical. And Yeats talks about the people who take over there. And people look at this as a great poem in sympathy for the rebellion, but in actuality, I don't think it is, right? The first stanza talks about how he's going to see these people and make fun of them. Right? Because my real friends, those at the club, those at the, you know, the leather wingback chair, upper class British club, we laugh at these people, right? These rebels. They may appear to be the only ones who act alive, as he says, they're the only ones who have vivid faces, vivere, meaning life full faces, right? Everything else looks kind of dead and gray. But he says that they are the ones who, you know, they're fools, they're buffoons. In fact, they but live, me and my buddies at the club, we only live where motley is worn. And if you look at the second page on Yeats, the Yeats images page, you see what motley is. And I apologize for that picture, but it's the only one I could find. It's what jesters or fools wear, right? He's calling them foolish here. This idea of national independence is way different, but it's changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. This oxymoron here, terrible beauty, right? And that refrain, all changed utterly, a terrible beauty is born. So that's the setup. And the second stanza is going to literally walk through four or five of the people that who led the rebellion. The first is Con Markowitz. Constance Gore Booth was her name before she got married. She ends up marrying a Polish count. She becomes Countess Markowitz. And she and Yeats were friends from childhood, where they did the typical upper class things. But she, as Yeats sees it, turned her back on the upper classes and threw her lot in with the lower classes, the middle classes, the poor, right? She starts out, right, she has ignorant goodwill, right? She means well, you know, it's the Irish equivalent, I guess, or the poetic equivalent of the Southern expression, oh, bless your heart, right? You can tell somebody anything, any incredible insult, as long as you preface it with bless your heart, right? She spent her days in ignorant goodwill. She meant well, but she just didn't know a lot. Her nights in argument until her voice grew shrill. But when she was young, right, she had a beautiful voice. When she did the things that the upper classes did, riding to harriers, as this says, right? When young and beautiful, she rode to harriers. Riding to harriers? I'm betting you probably haven't done it. It literally means fox hunting. Okay, not the kind of middle class or lower class thing people would do. But Maud, she turns her back on the upper classes and she grows old and shrill because of that. And there's Horrig Purse next, who rides the winged horse and keeps a school, and Thomas McBride, whose buddy, who is also a poet. And then this one last guy that he talks about, right? Who's very interesting, right? This other man, I had dreamed a drunken, vainglorious lout. He had done most bitter wrong to some who are near my heart. Now that's Major John McBride, who is who's the guy who marries Maud Gunn. He verbally and physically abused both Maud and their daughter Isolde, right? Now, Yates is so into Maud that 2 months after Maud turns him down for almost the last time, he asks Isolde to marry him. And she turns him down too. And at 3 or 4 months after that, he turns around and marries Georgie Hydeleys, who's kind of a Yates groupie, ships her off to the west of Ireland to a restored Norman castle called Tor Ballylee. And, you know, she just bears him children while he keeps his flats in London and in Dublin and maintains a long series of affairs. But here's John McBride. He says, he's a drunken, vainglorious lout, but I count him too, right? He too has been changed in his turn, right? A terrible beauty, right? Transformed utterly, a terrible beauty is born. And this third stanza is, remember when Douglas does that move where he paints that picture of the death of his grandmother, that composition of place move, where he wants to tell you this scene, he wants to describe this scene and put you in it? That's what this whole third stanza is about. It's this natural scene, right? He sets it up by making sure you get this connection. Hearts with one purpose alone through summer and winter seem enchanted to a stone, right? And now this stone is going to become the center of this natural scene where everything in the scene changes. The water, the clouds, a horse goes by, moorhens to moorcocks call, right? Minute by minute they live, the rider, the birds, right? All of these things change except for the stone. The stone looks like it doesn't change. And your heart can be like that stone. Now there's some biblical baggage there with stony hearts and things like that as well. But it's also this idea that they become hearts that focus on just one thing, become enchanted, become possessed, become caught under a spell. But life is about change. And in fact, let's face it, this poem's all about change. We can make a list of the things that change and the things that don't change. And just in case you don't get it, he's going to tell you that at the beginning of the fourth stanza, too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart. Well, focusing on one thing makes a stone of the heart, but too long a sacrifice makes a stone of the heart as well. Well, here are these rebels. They've made lots of sacrifices and their hearts have turned to stone again. When may it suffice? Right? When's it going to be enough? When will all our suffering, when will all our sacrifice be enough? When will we have our own free state? Right. Well, that's heaven's part to answer that. Yeats says, we can't answer that. Our part is just to remember these people, right? On limbs, right? As a mother names her child. And then this big idea, no, was it needless death after all? Did these people die needlessly? For England may keep faith for all that is done and said. Well, I got to tell you, England had been promising Ireland, I mean, almost annually, a set up, a constitution of an Irish free state for almost 200 years. Here's Yeats saying, oh, well, they might not be lying this time. Well, you know what? What's the line? Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Well, fool me 200 times. I don't know who gets shamed for that, right? But Yeats says England may keep faith, right? Why? Because he likes the status quo. He lives a really good life living this status quo, right? He doesn't really want rebellion. And let's face it, they didn't time that rebellion very well either. It's 1916. It's the middle of World War I. Ireland as a colony doesn't get to declare for a side. They're neutral. Now, granted, on the first day that England declared war, 50,000 Irishmen signed up to go fight with the English against, you know, the Axis powers. And here's this, you know, for the first time in centuries, literally, since, you know, especially because it was still within living memory, the great hunger, the great famine, where somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million people died in 3 years because of this famine. Yeats asked this question. What if excess of love bewildered them until they died? What if they loved too much that they were bewildered? They could not think straight. He's already called them enchanted or under a spell. They cannot think straight, right? This is not a man who's praising those revolutionaries, who's praising the institution of a republic. This is a man who says, I'm not so sure. I know that I'm supposed to say I want it, but hey, I got to tell you, I know what side my bread is buttered on. My life is much better now. I write it out in a verse, McDonough and McBride and Connolly and Peirce. Now and in time to be, wherever green is worn, or changed utterly, a terrible beauty is born. Well, we get that refrain again. And we can look at this poem and say, look what's happening here. Look at all the changes and all the things that change and all the things that don't change. That motley from stanza one becomes the green of stanza four. And I know green is not the Irish national color, but it's the color we most associate with Ireland. England's intransigence on home rule, on Irish self-governance, is not going to change. Although Yeats, you know, kind of ambiguously nods toward it, right? Day turns into night, the little kid falls asleep. Right? These people who were living all die. Everyone he mentions there in the second stanza gets executed except for the women at the head of the revolution. They were excused literally because they were women. So Con Markowitz gets to live, but everybody else gets executed. All that natural imagery in stanza three is all about change except for that stone. Yeats's stance doesn't change, but he keeps on saying everything has changed utterly, a terrible beauty is born. And I realize that this is getting a little long, so I'm going to break this into two parts. We'll have another shorter part about the next two poems coming up.